All right. Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, Biomarker Assessment and Related Treatment Decision-Making for Patients with Colorectal Cancer. My name is Chris Liu, and I'll be moderating the meeting for this event. All right. So we have an outstanding and international faculty here to discuss the new advances in colorectal cancer. And I want to just introduce them, Dr. Eric Van Cutsem from University Hospitals Leuven. We have Dr. Jenny Seligman from University of Leeds. We have Dr. Van Moores from MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Dr. Arvind Dasari, also from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. These are disclosures for our faculty. Okay, and here's our commercial support for today. Research to Practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no conflicts of interest to disclose. And this program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens, so please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. All right, so in order to make this meeting more relevant, there was a survey that went out to 50 general medical oncologists, and that was conducted earlier this month. And so there are questions that were provided during that survey and that will be asked to the faculty. And so you're going to hear wonderful presentations about the newest advances in colorectal cancer. We're going to go through some real-life cases to really put this data to the test and how we're going to apply that in the clinical scenario. And so this was our agenda for the evening. Dr. Dasari will start with a discussion about optimizing biomarker assessment for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer or colorectal cancer in general. We'll also talk a little bit about ctDNA. Dr. Moores will talk about BRAF V600E mutations and some emerging data there. Dr. Seligman will talk about incorporating immune checkpoint inhibitors into the management of MSI-high or deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. Professor Van Cutsem will discuss integration of therapies targeting HER2 into the management of metastatic colorectal cancer. And then I get to wrap up with a biomarker-based decision-making for patients that have KRAS G12C mutations. And so we're going to start with Dr. Dasari talking about optimizing biomarker assessment for patients with colorectal cancer. Dr. Dasari.
Thank you very much for the introduction. And as Dr. Liu just mentioned, I'll be talking about biomarkers in colorectal cancer, starting with validated biomarkers that are currently in clinical use. And then in the second part of the talk, I'll switch gears and talk about an emerging biomarker, ctDNA-based MRD monitoring, and how we may potentially use it in the near future. So these are some of the biomarkers that we consider for patients with colorectal cancer. Some of them are specific to colorectal cancer, such as RAS mutations or sitedness. Others are relevant across tumor types, such as HER2 new amplification. And some others have agnostic implications, such as deficient mismatch repair, fusions, such as NTRK, BRAF V600E, that's very relevant in colorectal cancer and also has an agnostic indication, as well as RET fusions. Well, the reality is life rarely ever fits into these neat boxes, and so there are a lot of interactions between these biomarkers. For instance, RAS mutations and BRAF V600E mutations are almost always mutually exclusive. There's a lot of overlap between MSI-high and BRAF V600E mutations, except in patients with Lynch syndrome. HER2 new amplifications tend to be more common in RAS wild-type patients, and fusions such as NTRK tend to be more common in patients who are MSI-high as well. So these are some of the established principles of biomarker testing per the NCCN guidelines. With regards to the type of biospecimen to be used, it can be performed on tissue or with blood-based assays. If being done on tissue, it can be primary or metastatic tissue. Microsatellite and germline testing should be offered to all patients irrespective of stage at diagnosis or age, because this is screening for Lynch syndrome. And in addition, germline testing for hereditary conditions should be recommended for younger patients who are younger than 50 years and also discussed with all patients. With regards to the mutations that we look for, these include extended RAS, BRAF mutations, BRAF V600E, and atypical BRAF mutations, mutations in polymerase enzymes E and D, and this typically is done with NGS. Fusions, several ways to look for them, including IHC or NGS, and the NGS could be DNA or RNA-based, although RNA-based methods may be slightly more sensitive and could also identify the fusion irrespective of the fusion partner. HER2 new amplification testing, there are slight differences from one tumor type to another. Typically tested with IHC in most patients and defined as 3+ staining in more than 50% of tumor cells. Or you could also use FISH, and the ratio needs to be at least 2. In patients who have IHC 2+, you do need to do follow-up FISH testing, and only patients who fulfill the criteria for FISH testing would be considered HER2 new amplified. And most of our current NGS panels also are able to report out these data. So this is kind of a detailed table of all the biomarkers that we currently use in patients with colorectal cancer, starting with MSI high or deficient mismatch repair. It's more common in early stage patients, and it's used as screening for Lynch syndrome and predictive for immunotherapy. Extended RAS testing includes KRAS and NRAS, exons 2 through 4, seen in about 50 to 60% of patients, and negatively predictive for EGFR therapy. BRAF mutations, V600D and atypical. The V600D is one that's been studied a lot more, and there's poor prognosis, and as we'll see, there's some new therapies for these patients. KRAS G12C, 2 to 3% of patients, and predictive for anti-KRAS G12C therapies. So with regards to liquid biopsies and when do we use them in patients with colorectal cancer, specifically metastatic colorectal cancer, I think we're increasingly using this in clinic. The thing to remember, though, is that when that liquid biopsy result comes back negative, consider tissue testing if no alterations are detected to avoid false negatives. And there are several use case scenarios for liquid biopsies, including tumor profiling at the time of diagnosis, and maybe when they have refractory disease to look for newer targets and clinical trials, and when they're in active therapy to see how they're doing on therapy. Two use case scenarios, which I think will likely enter clinic very soon, would be even in patients who are eligible for anti-EGFR therapy from the get-go based on established criteria, negative hyperselection, so that 10 to 20% of patients who seemingly qualify based on tissue testing, but when you do ctDNA testing, you find some other resistance mechanisms. And then in patients who have received these therapies, anti-EGFR therapies, and responded and then kind of progressed, thinking about EGFR rechallenge after those resistance mechanisms disappear. So moving on to ctDNA as a marker for MRD. The thing to remember is even in patients with metastatic disease, it's a small fraction, less than 10%, with the vast majority of circulating free DNA coming from the bone marrow. And in patients with MRD, it's less than 1%, but we now have several really good assays that are currently available and being developed. But it, by and large, could be grouped into tumor-informed versus tumor-agnostic. And these all have pros and cons to both approaches, with the tumor-informed as of now being perhaps a little more sensitive and being able to avoid more false positive, but the tumor-agnostic ones, because you don't need tumor tissue, are easier to do with a faster turnaround. So what are the use cases for MRD testing, and why is it such a powerful tool? Well, what we know is that it has a very high positive predictive value and high specificity. That is, anybody who's positive for this test almost invariably will recur without additional treatment. And so using this information, there are ongoing trials looking at whether we could escalate or de-escalate current adjuvant therapy. And then in patients who've completed all these therapies and who are on surveillance and then turn positive, there is a potential to develop new therapies because there's a lead time between turning ctDNA positive and turning positive on scans. So these are some of the data from observational studies. These are three separate studies that I'm showing here, cumulatively over 4,000 patients. And they all show that there's strong prognostic implications of being ctDNA or MRD negative versus positive immediately after surgery. And those hazard ratios for recurrence are in double digits, ranging from 12 to 20%. So how do patients who are MRD negative do with or without adjuvant chemotherapy? The answer is they do well no matter what, even if they don't get adjuvant therapy. And these are really compelling data from these observational studies. On the flip side, patients who are MRD positive don't do as well. So without any adjuvant therapy, they're almost always destined to recur. With adjuvant therapy, we are perhaps preventing recurrences in a proportion of these patients, but still, they're nowhere as close to the outcomes that we're seeing in patients who are MRD negative. So with regards to randomized studies, so far we've seen observational studies. The data, best data we have are from the DYNAMIC trial that was a non-inferiority design, enrolled stage 2 patients, and showed that ctDNA-guided therapy is non-inferior to standard of care therapy, and updated results at 5 years confirmed what was noted at 2 years. And what was relevant is that the ctDNA-guided group got much less chemotherapy with this, similar outcomes. So the unanswered questions, can adjuvant chemotherapy be de-escalated in higher-risk patients, such as high-risk stage 2 or stage 3? What is the role of serial monitoring of ctDNA for de-escalation? And can we escalate adjuvant therapy in ctDNA-positive patients? And these are questions being answered by ongoing trials across the globe. This is an ongoing clinical trial here in North America, CIRCULATE North America, that is trying to answer these questions. And I would highly encourage that and everybody consider enrolling onto this trial. In patients who are on surveillance, we know that there's a lead time of about 6 to 9 months. And this would be a potent area for drug development and to develop new novel therapies. And this is an area of huge interest overall because we still don't know what to do with these patients. And there are several trials that are ongoing. The ALTAIR trial that is being done in this setting will be reported out tomorrow. And in addition, there are several other studies that are being reported out and including a kind of post-hoc analysis of 80702 that looked at the use of celecoxib. And we're looking at the outcomes of treatment with celecoxib in ctDNA negative versus positive patients. And we'll also have the final analysis of the bespoke cohort. Thank you very much.
Great, wonderful presentation, Dr. Dasari, and thank you for touching on ctDNA and minimal residual disease, because as you might imagine from the survey of the 50 general medical oncologists that you were asked about what they wanted to hear about, there's a lot of information I think people want about how to incorporate ctDNA into clinical practice. And I think that you'll see some of these questions that came from the survey are really gonna reflect that interest as well. But we'll start with some of the questions that have come from our survey. And Dr. Seligman, I think I'll start with you. You know, are there any noticeable differences in testing biomarkers from the primary tumor versus the metastatic site, like a liver or lung? So if you have that sample from a colonoscopy or you have a liver biopsy, do we need to be testing both? Should we test one or the other? Does it really matter?
So I think that if there's... I think if you have a biopsy from a previous tumor, I think that probably is okay. I think the issue is if you did, so if there's several metastases, which one is the best one to biopsy, and we know that there is heterogeneity between metastases. So I think that probably nothing is perfect, and I think ctDNA will help us out with that. But usually, if I have tissue and molecular testing from a previous diagnosis, then I would usually be quite happy to base my first treatment on that.
Yeah, no, totally agree. You know, to the point of liquid biopsy, Dr. Morris, you know, what is the role of liquid biopsy in relapse disease? And you heard Dr. Dasari kind of touch on that during his presentation. Would you recommend, you know, running this type of liquid biopsy tumor mutational analysis at every, you know, progression or relapse? You know, what is the cadence that you would recommend, or when do you utilize liquid biopsy testing?
Yeah, I mean, we always tell our fellows at MD Anderson, if you're going to order a test, you know, you need to know how you're going to act based on how the various ways that test can come back. So I think for me, you know, when we're managing patients with, you know, metastatic disease, if that result can inform on, you know, my decisioning, how I'm going to counsel the patient, I think the most obvious kind of one that screams out to me is kind of as Dr. Dasari had mentioned in the anti-EGFR challenge, because we know these patients can acquire, you know, KRAS mutations or other MAP kinase activating mutations at the time of progression on these therapies. So, you know, this can, I think, be informative as we're talking to patients, you know, and thinking about anti-EGFR rechallenge, you know, what is the likelihood for success with that kind of based on, you know, what the liquid biopsy results can show.
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those things where we wish we had more targeted therapies, right, in metastatic colorectal cancer. But if we think about anti-EGFR therapy, would you require a liquid biopsy to show no evidence of KRAS, NRAS, BRAF mutations before you try that rechallenge?
I would say yes, if available, and that would really inform us the benefit that the patient might get from rechallenge. If you do not have access to a liquid biopsy or a liquid biopsy with a large enough panel, then perhaps kind of waiting as long as possible before doing that rechallenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Van Cutsem, a real-life example of, you know, using ctDNA in the MRD space. So in stage 2 colon cancer, should we routinely get initial post-op ctDNA to decide on adjuvant therapy, including for historical high-risk populations, those with obstruction, lymphovascular invasion, perforation? How often, if at all, should ctDNA be ordered for surveillance?
Difficult questions, but really important questions, I think. Classically, historically, we looked at criteria that are mentioned here, number of lymph nodes, lymphatic or vascular invasion, whether there was perforation. But I'm convinced that looking at circulating DNA immediately after the operation helps us to differentiate really high risk versus low risk, because that's what we're doing. And we have more and more evidence that it's not only prognostic, but also predictive. And that's what is relevant here. Does it help to predict some of the benefit? You can always discuss the data. They are not perfect, but to my opinion, they are quite strong. How often it should be done, that's for discussion. And I think there, at least to my opinion, we don't have strict guidance in this setting. We could do it after the operation, then at the end of adjuvant treatment, and then probably every 6 months. I would not do every 2 months, but like in a normal surveillance program, if you look at some of the different guidelines coming from ASCO or ESMO or whatever for the surveillance, but at that, then at the different moments of surveillance, that's what I would recommend and do.
That's great. Yeah, it's definitely an evolving field. Dr. Morris.
I was just going to say in the last slide, with regards to the perforation as well, obviously when we do test these patients and see, you know, an undetected ctDNA result, that's great news. But patients with perforation, you know, clinically may be at higher risk for developing peritoneal disease down the road as well. So I think when we see some of these high-risk features, you know, peritoneal disease, lung metastases, these may be less with current ctDNA technologies, you know, detected as opposed to liver metastases. So, you know, even if a patient has a negative ctDNA result yet has perforation, I still want to keep a very close eye on what's happening in the peritoneum when these patients are coming back for their scans. So these are some of the kind of the the discussions we have with, you know, our patients, of course, in celebrating a negative ctDNA result, but, you know, with some caution as well, just...
Yeah, I completely agree. And for me, patients with a perforation, even with a negative circulating DNA in stage two, that's a strong indication. That's a T4 tumor. That's a strong indication for even go probably for 6 months instead of 2 months of adjuvant oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy.
Yep. Great points. And, you know, I think what we have right now is a lot of great observational data. We have that from Galaxy. We have that from Bespoke. At the same time, some of these questions really hopefully will be answered in the context of a randomized clinical trial. And not to be overly self-serving, but Dr. Dasari, you know, is the PI of that study, and we hope that people will enroll to it. All right, Dr. Dasari, 69-year-old woman with stage 2A PT3N0 colon cancer. So, you know, kind of our classic low-risk stage 2. ctDNA was negative postoperatively, but turned positive at 3 months in this patient that has not received chemotherapy yet. Would you initiate adjuvant chemotherapy?
So this is a patient who, based on the information we have, is at a high risk of developing recurrent disease. And the first thing I would ask is, when was the last scan done, and repeat imaging to make sure that there's no overt disease already. Assuming that those scans are negative, then that would be truly MRD positive. And we know that the patient is at a very, very high risk of recurrence. So based on that observation, I would advocate for starting adjuvant chemotherapy, preferably with an oxaliplatin-containing regimen.
Dr. Van Cutsen?
I'm not sure. First of all, I don't think we would not do, at least in our setting, at 3 months circulating DNA. We would recommend to do that after the operation, and then if that was negative, then do it after 6 months. If after 6 months it's positive, then and imaging is negative, just based on circulating DNA alone, I would not start with chemotherapy. 3 months is a difficult period, but there are some older data that looked at the benefit, the relative benefit of adjuvant, strictly adjuvant chemotherapy. At 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, there was a meta-analysis published in JAMA some decades ago, if I remember well. And that showed that after 3 months, the benefit, if there was any benefit, the benefit was really very modest and minimal. So I'm not sure I would do that if imaging was negative.
Okay. And I think that this is an area where we're not sure. Dr. Seligman?
Yeah, I think this highlights the need for standardized follow-up and standardized procedures, because I think the danger is that people do different things and then we get out of any evidence base. And it's very, very then difficult to communicate the risk and what does that one reading mean? I think it's very hard. And again, I just want to support the ongoing trial, and because not only does it give you the result, but it also will provide a framework for how patients should be treated in the future.
Yep. No, I totally agree. Dr. Dasari.
And so the CIRCULATE trial, by the way, Dr. Liu and I are co-leading that. So there are two cohorts. In cohort A, so patients who are ctDNA negative would be monitored on the de-escalation arm and offered adjuvant therapy if and when they turn positive. So this question will be answered. The control arm being getting adjuvant chemotherapy immediately after surgery. So addresses this question exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I love this discussion because it really reflects the quandary that our clinicians are in with a test that is obviously incredibly prognostic, but kind of simultaneously, we have to do something with these results when they come in at 3-6 months. And right now, I think the field is a little bit unclear. And we certainly need additional data, but the reality is that these are the patients that we're seeing right now. Dr. Morris, you know, not all patients with stage 3 colon cancer are super excited about adjuvant chemotherapy. So if you have a 73-year-old gentleman with stage 3A colorectal cancer, how strongly would you push for adjuvant therapy in a patient with T2N1 disease, 1 out of 23 nodes, so truly, you know, kind of lower risk stage 3 with negative ctDNA? The patient consented to adjuvant CAPOX, but is very, now in italics here, reluctant. So, you know, would you utilize ctDNA in this setting? How would you counsel this patient?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at 10 years ago, this patient would have gotten 6 months of FOLFOX chemotherapy. So there certainly, you know, have been evolving trials, the idea trial, you know, about de-escalation based on clinical, you know, and pathologic findings. This patient, you know, standard practice would be, you know, with one lymph node, you know, 3 months of CAPOX, you know, at our institution. I would treat this patient, I mean, in standard practice, I would treat this patient with chemotherapy. I would not personally de-escalate up front based on the negative ctDNA result. This is exactly the question that the Circulate US trial is looking at, you know, in patients who are negative, can we get away with observation, close observation in these patients as opposed to adjuvant chemotherapy if surgery truly has cleared all of their disease. But I would be very hesitant just to, especially in a curative intent patient, to do that without that data.
Yeah, and I think I see wide agreement, right, across the panel. Dr. Seligman?
Yeah, no, I mean, in the UK, we have a trial where we're looking at de-escalating the chemotherapy. So in this situation, there would be the option to drop the oxaliplatin, which again, in an over 70s, would be a completely reasonable thing to do anyway. Mm-hmm. So that would be another option in that situation that they could just have capecitabine alone without the additional toxicity of the oxaliplatin. I think in this situation, I'd probably feel quite comfortable with that, with a reluctant patient.
Or the other option could be to give really to stop at 3 months. This is a patient not for 6 months of adjuvant treatment, so that's a kind of de-escalation already from 6 to 3 months.
Totally agree. All right, great discussion. We could probably sit here and talk about ctDNA and the minimal residual disease setting really all night. But we'll move on right now to our next talk. Dr. Van Morris is going to discuss the identification and management of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer and BRAF V600E mutations, a vastly evolving field. Quickly.
Yeah, I think, so thank you for allowing me to be here today. I think this is an exciting weekend to be in San Francisco to hear about kind of updates in the BRAF V600E colorectal cancer setting. So this, as I was preparing this talk, I kind of noticed that all of the trials for BRAF mutated CRC, the Anchor trial, the Breakwater trial, all have these nautical themes. So I asked ChatGPT to create a cartoon of me talking at sea about BRAF mutated CRC, and this is what it spit out. So it's a very flattering picture, but it made it fun to prepare these slides. So I'll be talking briefly about some of the rationale for BRAF EGFR use and the management of patients with BRAF mutated metastatic CRC. I'm going to talk about some of the data which has become publicly available regarding the Breakwater study, which will be reported tomorrow in the oral abstract section, looking at chemotherapy and BRAF EGFR targeted therapies as a combination, and then kind of talk about what is the evolving role potentially of immunotherapy in this patient population as well. So to start, I just want to kind of remind that the BRAF mutated population is, you know, both a clinically and pathologically unique subset of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. We know that the prognostically, the survival is not as good as patients who have BRAF wild type CRC, but there's also certain, you know, pathologic factors that we see. These tend to be more right-sided at presentation, often kind of a higher T stage, poorly differentiated. And we do see, you know, higher coexisting rates of microsatellite instability, high tumors as well in this population. There's also kind of oncologic differences. These tend to have higher like methylation patterns, as well as unique kind of transcriptomic RNA pattern, you know, profiles. And we'll kind of go back to this later, but oftentimes we see that BRAF V600E tumors are characterized by what we call consensus molecular subtype 1, which is an immune activation phenotype, consensus molecular subtype 4 as well, which is more of an epithelial to mesenchymal immune phenotype as well. So when we think about BRAF V600E mutations, these occur in around, you know, I'd say 8 to 10% of all patients with a diagnosis of colorectal cancer. And this is the case with other BRAF mutated solid tumors. These mutations activate the MAP kinase pathway, which, you know, ultimately leads to tumor cell growth and cell proliferation. So this is an actionable mutation. We see that in other solid tumors like melanoma, non-small cell lung cancer, BRAF inhibitors as monotherapy work in about 30 to 40% of the cases. And if you add a MEK inhibitor, these numbers can increase to as much as, you know, in this 60% overall response rate. So same exact mutation, but apply that to colorectal cancer. And what do you see? You see much lower overall response rates with the same, you know, BRAF inhibitors as monotherapy or in combination with a MEK inhibitor. We're going from the 40s to 70s to the 5 to 12%. So why are these, you know, what is going on that's different about colorectal cancer? And I think this is one of the, you know, the most, as a gastrointestinal medical oncologist, elegant examples of really bench to bedside medicine that we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years. It was reported kind of when they looked in the lab that when you block this BRAF V600E oncoprotein with a BRAF inhibitor, you get this reflexive upregulation of EGFR signaling, which then can continue to propagate the oncogenic pathways. The nice thing about that, of course, is that we have drugs which can target, compensatory EGFR upregulation. And that's kind of where, you know, I think about almost 6 years ago now, the first kind of phase three trial was reported looking at the role of targeted therapies in the management of patients with treatment refractory BRAF mutated metastatic colorectal cancer. This is the Beacon trial. It was reported in or published in 2019. It was a phase three trial. Again, patients in the second line setting and beyond with BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer. They were randomized to either chemotherapy, as you can see in the bottom with irinotecan and cetuximab, the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib with cetuximab, or on the top, a BRAF EGFR MEK combination. You can see an improvement in the overall response rate with the BRAF EGFR of 20% and the BRAF EGFR MEK of 26%. But interestingly, when you look at the overall survival on the left, you can see the overall survival for the BRAF MEK EGFR. Overall survival was 9.3 months. When you look at encorafenib and cetuximab without the MEK inhibitor, 9.3 months. The same exact overall median survival with or without the MEK inhibitor. I think it's also important to note, when you look at the PFS curves at the bottom, you can see that for patients who got control in the treatment refractory setting, median PFS was 1.5 months. So these patients are progressing very quickly once they've progressed on frontline chemotherapy. So this led to the first FDA approval in the United States for BRAF mutated CRC with encorafenib and cetuximab. Because there was not an improvement in overall survival, the addition of the MEK inhibitor did not, was not included in that FDA approval. We've seen that there are certain genomic markers, which, you know, I think are kind of interest. For the sake of time, I'll kind of briefly go through this. These combinations have been looked at in other settings as well. Dr. Van Cutsem kind of led this effort, the ANCHOR trial. This was a phase two trial looking at the same BRAF MEK EGFR combination I just referred to. However, this is in patients with untreated BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer. So you can see here an overall response rate of 48%. With a median overall survival of median PFS of around 6 months and a median overall survival of about a year and a half, so a very nice waterfall plot for a otherwise poor prognostic population. And that kind of brings us to another trial which we're excited to hear more about tomorrow, the Breakwater trial. This is a phase three trial where they looked where the team looked at saying, can we use the Beacon regimen of encorafenib and cetuximab and see if adding that to systemic chemotherapy improves the outcomes of patients with untreated BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer. And this came from the press release last month from the FDA for the accelerated approval for this positive study. But you can see that with in the frontline setting, overall response rate of adding the BRAF EGFR combination to chemotherapy, an improvement from 40% to 61%, as well as an extended duration of response in those who did achieve a response. So excited to hear more details about this tomorrow, but we do anticipate that this will become, you know, a standard of care for these patients. So in the final minutes, we'll talk kind of about what is the role of immunotherapy in patients with BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer. I'm going to start by talking about patients with microsatellite stable disease. So again, this is a population for whom immunotherapy does alone tends not to have, you know, significant efficacy. This is a trial that we did at MD Anderson where we looked at the Beacon regimen, encorafenib and cetuximab with nivolumab in patients with previously treated treatment refractory BRAF V600E MSS CRC. We saw in the bottom left here an overall response rate of 50%, you know, which we thought was very promising. And then the bottom middle, in the bottom two figures, you can see that there are patients who are staying on this combination for years. So for the first time, we felt we started seeing kind of a tail of the curve with the addition of the PD-1 therapy. There certainly are differences kind of in translational analyses that we identified between the two groups, and for the sake of time, I'll skip quickly over that. But this, you know, these findings of kind of combining MAP kinase targeted therapies with immunotherapy were kind of validated in a different group out of MGH in Boston, where they looked at a BRAF-MEK PD-1 combination, and again saw promising signal in, you know, some of the patients with this disease as well. So we, to study this more formally, this is a study that was supported by the NCI here in the United States, the SWOG-2107 study. It's a randomized trial looking at the Beacon regimen of encorafenib and cetuximab in the treatment refractory setting with alone or in combination with nivolumab. That study closed or completed enrollment this past fall, and we anticipate that readout hopefully later this year or at the latest early next year. So the final question, or kind of to talk about, is the role of immunotherapy in patients with MSI-high BRAF V600E colorectal cancer. And this is kind of publicly available data from the KEYNOTE-177 study, which looked at pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, where, of course, PD-1 therapy, you know, showed better outcomes, and then the CheckMate HHW data that was published last year looking at dual checkpoint inhibition with nivolumab and ipilimumab. But the thing that I would bring to your attention, and it's in the kind of highlighted in the red boxes here, is that in both of these studies, patients with if they had an MSI-high tumor, the presence of a BRAF V600E mutation, these patients still benefited from immunotherapy. So one of the common questions I get at MD Anderson from outside doctors is, I have a patient with an MSI-high tumor, but I saw a BRAF mutation. I know that this is bad. Prognostically, can I give these patients immunotherapy? And I think the data certainly supports that. There is a trial looking at adding encorafenib and cetuximab to pembrolizumab monotherapy. You can see the schema here. The CMARC trial has completed accrual as well, and I think will help to answer the question of what the role of BRAF EGFR therapy could be specifically in this population of patients. For the sake of time, I may just skip through these. We can talk about them later. But just kind of in summary, I think, again, the landscape is evolving rapidly for patients with BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer. In the front line, I think, as we'll see tomorrow, chemotherapy plus encorafenib and cetuximab will improve survival outcomes, and I think will become the standard of care for many. If a patient, for whatever reason, cannot tolerate chemotherapy, certainly, again, the BRAF EGFR MET combination has shown some promising activity. And then again, for the treatment refractory patients, encorafenib, cetuximab, if they have not received a prior BRAF therapy in the frontline setting, would be the standard of care. And we're excited about the trials coming forward looking at immunotherapy. And then again, as I said, for the frontline MSI high patients, think about immunotherapy. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Morris. Okay, rapidly evolving field, right? And BRAF mutations just confer such a poor prognosis. It's really exciting to see good data, right? And FDA approvals come through for this subset of patients with BRAF mutation positive colorectal cancer. So Dr. Van Cutsem, in a BRAF mutation positive patient with metastatic colorectal cancer, should we now start with FOLFOX plus encorafenib and cetuximab for everyone? Or are there still patients for whom we should start with FOLFIRINOX plus bevacizumab and then utilize encorafenib cetuximab in a later line setting at the time of relapse or progression?
Difficult question without disclosing the data that will be presented tomorrow, because they're still under embargo. But having seen what was disclosed and what just Van said, yes, the answer would be I would start rather for a chemo plus targeted therapy, so FOLFOX, encorafenib, cetuximab. Before we had these data, I didn't start in all patients with the triplet FOLFIRINOX plus BEV, so depended a little bit on the clinical biology, on the general condition of the patients. So stay tuned for the data of tomorrow, but my favorite, based on what we know today, we haven't seen survival data today, but would be FOLFOX and encorafenib cetuximab.
Okay, great. I see nodding across the panel, and certainly we'll await that oral abstract presentation tomorrow. Dr. Seligman, 65-year-old female with metastatic colon cancer, de novo with liver mets. She and Dr. Morris had kind of brought this scenario up. She has MSI-high disease and a BRAF V600E mutation. Dr. Morris showed us that data. She progressed on frontline pembrolizumab. What would you recommend now? And so the question being, would you start that patient now on what Dr. Van Cutsem just mentioned, FOLFOX and combination targeted therapy, or start with just a targeted therapy without chemotherapy? And again, knowing that we haven't seen the late-breaking abstract and the data quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think a number of things come into this decision. I mean, I think for somebody, particularly if they had a high burden of disease, I'd have a very low threshold to start them on Breakwater. So not MSI, not all MSI high disease is equal. And actually for somebody with, you know, perhaps they had, you know, lower volume disease, I think you could actually sequence and get away with doing that. And that, I think that's very valid. But I think if she was somebody with liver mets, I'm going to assume she's not done very well on her first line pembro, then I'd be very quick to move her to the Breakwater regime upon what we think might be shown.
To be determined data, yes, correct. Hard questions to answer in the absence of seeing the full report, so... Dr. Dasari, would encorafenib cetuximab be acceptable as a first-line systemic therapy for a 70-year-old man who has had FOLFOX previously for stage 3 colon cancer 12 months ago and has residual neuropathy from that therapy and wishes to avoid 5-FU again? And again, you know, knowing that we don't have that data.
Yeah, exactly. But, I think we do have to wait until tomorrow to kind of get a sense of what to do. But I would try to sit down with the patient and discuss what the concerns were with regards to avoiding 5-FU. Certainly understandable about avoiding oxaliplatin given your neuropathy. But if the patient wants to avoid 5-FU as well, what are the concerns there? What I don't know as yet is kind of combining capecitabine with encorafenib cetuximab if the concern is around having a chemo pump. That would be another question. So, but if the patient absolutely wants to avoid cytotoxic chemotherapy, period, then I think proceeding with encorafenib cetuximab would be very reasonable.
Professor
Van Cutsem. Yeah, just to add, we have, as was explained by Van, published the ANCHOR study, which was on just in first line, encorafenib cetuximab in this setting with response rates of 48%. So I think based on these data, I think that's probably a good option for these patients, especially with the neuropathy and if he doesn't want fluoropyrimidine again.
With the ANCHOR study, that regimen did include binimetinib, correct? Is there a situation where you would include the MEK inhibitor with the encorafenib and the cetuximab?
No, there's no situation as far as we know. Historically, we started the ANCHOR study. At the moment, we didn't have yet the results of the BEACON. Right. We thought the triplet would be better, triplet with a MEK inhibitor, but in the end, at least in second and third line, triplet was not better than doublet. So I think we can translate that to first line, that there is no reason, at least as far as today, to include the binimetinib in this setting. There may be some patients, but we don't know who this is, so this is a strong recommendation not to do it.
Yep. So Dr. Morris, I can assume we saw the data with FOLFOX, but can encorafenib and cetuximab be combined with other upfront chemotherapy regimens if the patient is not a good candidate for FOLFOX?
I mean, so there, was a safety lead-in for the Breakwater study where they looked at FOLFIRI with encorafenib and cetuximab. And certainly in small numbers, the numbers look very good and comparable, I think, to the FOLFOX. So I think the answer is probably so. I think this is being looked at more formally and be reported, in the larger kind of phase three update with the FOLFIRI arm as well. Yep. I think the answer is probably yes, it can be. I think the more salient question for all of us as oncologists is insurance going to pay for that? Right. So that, may be the rate limiting step, but I think in theory, the answer is probably yes. And I would just say, when we think about, just kind of this synergy you see between anti-EGFR therapies and irinotecan as well.
Right.
We're doing a BRAF EGFR regimen. It just makes sense that if FOLFOX is working well, FOLFIRI is going to work very well too.
And the safety lead-in with FOLFIRI and encorafenib cetuximab showed high response rates.
Yeah, exactly.
Very
it's
high.
It's a small number of patients, but response rates were extremely high.
Mm-hmm. Great points. Dr. Seligman, I think we all have patients that have BRAF V600E mutations who have appear to have very aggressive biology. We also have some patients with BRAF V600E mutations that seem to have fairly indolent disease, at least comparatively. So we know that some patients do respond well to this therapy. Some patients will kind of progress straight through it. Do we have any ideas in terms of what the patient population is that may respond or may not respond as well?
I don't think we have anything that we can use in everyday clinical practice. I think it's fair. I think we know that there are subpopulations within the BRAF, not just clinically, but molecularly. But to my knowledge, and I look at Dr. Morris because he's more likely to know than me, there's nothing that we would be able to use in day-to-day practice. And actually, the BRAF inhibitors are still the best way to go.
Yeah, totally agree. Dr. Morris?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that the BRAF V600E population is not a one-size-fits-all population, and there is clear, biologic heterogeneity, in the populations. And, we kind of talked a little bit about the CMS 1 and 4, within the MSS BRAF V600E patients. But I think that, multiple groups have annotated this heterogeneity differently. So this is something that we see clinically as well, this is why the translational studies on trials are so critical. And, I think maybe there's a path forward to, dissecting further these patients and, personalizing treatments even more potentially.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of those analyses, in the Breakwater study as well. So Dr. Dasari, if a patient progresses on first-line FOLFOX, cetuximab, and encorafenib, what is the optimal second-line therapy?
Yeah, so we I don't think we have kind of second-line anti-BRAF V600E-directed therapies currently, hopefully in the near future. So for now, I would treat this patient with an irinotecan-based regimen, perhaps FOLFIRI, with bevacizumab if there are no contraindications for Bev.
And Professor Van Cutsem, any role for BRAF inhibitors for non-V600E mutations? So this is a 64-year-old gentleman with a BRAF V600F mutation. And we see these, right, in clinic. There's a percentage of patients that have these. So.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's important to teach on that. V600E in the group of BRAF mutations is the most frequent, but we have V600F and some others, what we call non-V600E. They have a much better prognosis. They have a similar prognosis compared to the BRAF wild-type patients, and they behave also similar. So they may respond to chemo plus an EGFR antibody. There are no data of BRAF inhibitors in this setting, and that's not indicated in this group of patients.
Absolutely. And to wrap up this section, Dr. Seligman, any data on adjuvant BRAF inhibition, right, for early stage colon cancer?
Not yet. I think there are ongoing studies in the, in the adjuvant and the neoadjuvant setting based upon MRD positivity. So again, just trying to be a bit smart and get your high-risk population. So certainly it's not something you would do right now, but again, consider enrolling onto a clinical trial if possible.
Absolutely. Yep. Thank you. Okay, great discussion. We're going to move on to the incorporation of immune checkpoint inhibitors in the management of MSI-high deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. So Dr. Seligman.
Thank you for the introduction. It's a real pleasure to escape the UK winter to be here with you in San Francisco. So my remit for today is to talk about incorporation of immune checkpoint inhibitors in the management of, and I'm just going to refer to them as MSI-high colorectal cancer, but of course, deficient mismatch repair as well. So in this talk, we're going to cover several treatment indications. First of all, locally advanced rectal cancer, locally advanced colon cancer, and metastatic colorectal cancer, and really talk about how what is the implication of MSI status and what are the opportunities for immuno-oncology and what are possible future developments. So some of this has already been talked about. Increasingly, MSI-high tumors are considered as a separate group completely in colorectal cancer, and they're characterized by high tumor mutation burden and increased immunogenicity. Guidelines endorse testing on all colorectal cancer tumors, and it's a really interesting thing that we see. Again, we've just talked about heterogeneity in BRAF mutant tumors. We see this in MSI-high as well. And across the stages, we see different infiltrations of immune cells into the tumors, which must then lead to difference in prevalence, so higher prevalence in stage 2 than stage 4, but also prognosis, so an excellent prognosis in stage 2, and prior to the era of immuno-oncology, a worse prognosis than MSS in stage 4. And if you are a GI oncologist, you must have been living under a rock if you haven't seen some of this data. So first of all, we see the Shalabi plot in colon cancer. We've seen these incredible complete clinical responses in rectal cancer and these curves that you can fit a bus in between in metastatic colorectal cancer. And this really, for us, in my opinion, represents a complete paradigm change. So what are the implications for routine clinical practice in 2025? So let's start with locally advanced rectal cancer. Now, standard of care used to be chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and surgery, and this had unbelievable implications on people's long-term health recurrences, but also long-term morbidity as well. And so the study from MSK hypothesized that by giving MSI-high tumors dostarlimab, that we could start to see complete clinical responses. And what happened is that patients had 6 months of dostarlimab. They had they were reassessed by both imaging and endoscopy. And patients who had achieved a clinical complete response had the opportunity to pursue a non-operative management course. But of course, if there was residual disease, there was opportunity to go back to our standard of care. And again, I think we're all familiar with what they found. They found that there was a 100% complete clinical response rate, which was just astounding. I remember being in the room in ASCO. Nobody could almost believe what they were seeing. But it's one thing looking at the waterfall plot. It was a completely other thing looking at the endoscopic images, seeing this really nasty looking tumor to a normal looking rectum. So the question is, does this data merit practice change? There is limitations. So this is from one center. There's lack of long-term data, lack of randomization. But can we really randomize dostarlimab versus radiotherapy, surgery, and chemotherapy. And I think we all agree that that would be unacceptable to both us and our patients. And so ongoing is the AZURE-1 trial, which is a phase 2 single-arm, open-label, really a confirmatory study in stage 2 to 3 dMMR rectal cancer. And this is completed enrolling, and we will await the results next year. However, the FDA have granted breakthrough therapy designation for dostarlimab, and so this is something that is available to give, but certainly not universally, and we can't do this in the EU, for example. So let's move on to locally advanced colon cancer. So for MSI-high locally advanced colon cancer, standard of care is surgical resection, then oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy. And we're awaiting the results of the ATOMIC trial, looking at the addition of atezolizumab to adjuvant chemotherapy. But across immunogenic cancers, we've got very strong evidence that actually immunotherapy is far better given when the primary tumor is in situ in terms of surmounting the immune response. So we both have data in other cancers and very clear rationale to give it in the neoadjuvant setting rather than the adjuvant setting. And there has been several different reports, all single arm, looking at the impact of delivering immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting in colon cancer. And again, we've seen the Shalabi plot. And again, similarly to the rectal cancer data, this is really astounding data. We've not seen pathological responses so high ever. But this does lead to more questions in our daily practice today. So how long do we give this for? So all of these papers have shown they've given it for completely different times. And what we can see is if we're giving PD-1, you need to give it for a while to get these pathological complete response rates. And another question is, do we need combination when we could have single agent? And what I would say is what we've seen in the combination studies is that a short period results in high PCR rates, but they can be also achieved with a longer duration with single agents. But I would have to say there's marked heterogeneity of the study designs, which then leads to a real problem in progressing to routine standard of care. But a big question that everybody had was, does the short-term efficacy that we've talked about translate into long-term cancer control? And at ESMO this year, we saw the NICHE-2 trial report an unprecedented 100% recurrence-free rate at 3 years. We did see one in NICHE-3, but just to put this in context, for patients that were selected in a similar manner in the Foxtrot trial, the recurrence rate was 15%. So this, I think, this is really important data. But does this data merit practice change? Does this change the way that we treat our patients? I think there's some easy answers here. Certainly for tumors that it's difficult to achieve an R0 resection without multivisceral resections, absolutely. And those populations were well represented in NICHE and is endorsed by the NCCN guidelines. In T3, T4 tumors, this is a bit more tricky. And what is the benefit compared with standard of care? None of these studies are randomized. So what do we need to move the field forward? I mean, for me, I think we are quite convinced that immunotherapy is likely to work better, is likely to correspond to superior long-term cancer control, and is usually better tolerated. But some people would argue that these people have good prognosis tumors and they're cured by surgery. So what next? I think the patient voice is going to be critical, but let's just focus on one of these ongoing trials, which is the AZURE-2 trial, which will look to answer that question, looking at perioperative dostarlimab compared with upfront surgery and standard of care chemotherapy. One thing I just want to point out is what is the risk what's the emerging safety data? I mean, the risk of grade 5 IO toxicity is small but important, particularly in the early stage. And the MHTEP study presented at ESMO as well would urge caution with baseline patient frailty. The other really interesting thing is we're starting to see tumor stricturing associated with complete response, which can then lead to bowel obstruction. So look out for this, particularly with tumors at the flexure. So just be aware that this is an important risk. And remember, low-grade endocrinopathies can mean lifelong treatment, and that's really important as well. So I'm going to skip through this trial. This is this slide. This is just some of the things that we need to think about. The main point of this slide is to say if we're going to give neoadjuvant either rectal or colon immunotherapy, we have to think about the way that our patients go through the patient pathway and at what point we do testing. So again, Dr. Morris has helpfully pointed out some of the features of immunotherapy in metastatic colorectal cancer. And what we have is very clear guidelines that we can use immunotherapy in MSI-high metastatic colorectal cancer in any line of therapy. And I think we're all aware of the KEYNOTE-177 trial. A few things for me to point out. I think the Kaplan-Meier curves here are extremely informative. So it tells us of two completely different populations. Number one, it tells us about our long-term benefiters, so people alive at 5 years. We've not seen this before, metastatic colorectal cancer. This is a paradigm change. But we also have this group here who are progressing very quickly and, if anything, did better with chemotherapy initially. Who are these patients? We don't have clues from the subgroup analyses. HHW, again, I think we're aware of this. We're seeing fewer early progressors and more patients on the long-term benefit trajectory. And again, the key analysis is something that we will again see tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be an exciting day, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so we're going to see this. So who needs, is combination Nivo-Ipi actually better than Nivo itself? So that's the key analysis from this trial, in my opinion. So where are we in 2025? It's quite difficult to draw direct comparisons between these trials, but I think we can say we're seeing lower discontinuation due to PD with the combination, but that either is better than first line. We'll see the data tomorrow. And remember that I think we have moved this up to first line in the main. I think we do want to give our best options in the first line, but we do have data from CheckMate 142, reassuringly showing us that it works in other lines of therapy. Just to finish off, I think there's lots of unanswered questions in future directions. So who needs doublet compared with PD-1 alone? Who are these early progressors? Can we identify them? Is there a better alternative upfront regimen? What do we do with residual stable disease? So on a patient who has an area of visible cancer which isn't moving over subsequent scans, should we resect it? How do you optimally manage a MSI-high patient post-progression? And we'll wait to see how the next generation of IO agents change the current landscape. So in my opinion, the conclusion is that enormous progress is being made in the treatment of MSI-high colorectal cancer, and this has really led to transformative patient benefits, potentially in all of the treatment indications that we've talked about tonight. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Seligman. Okay, if anything, I think we're building enough anticipation for tomorrow, so that's a good thing. But it's always super fun to talk about data that's really coming out that's going to change the way we practice, and I think that's what we're going to see in the coming 24 hours. All right, Dr. Dasari, what are the real-world indications for IO in non-metastatic MSI-high rectal cancer, given the small sample size of patients in whom dostarlimab was used, but obviously had marvelous responses, and Dr. Seligman obviously touched on this, but tell us how you incorporate this into your workflow.
Yeah, I mean, kind of remarkable data, and those data were supported from several other trials as well. So it's not just that trial supporting the use of IO in rectal cancer and MSI-high patients. I would say that it is reasonable to consider this as a potential therapy, immunotherapy in these patients to avoid chemoradiation and or surgery. Will require multidisciplinary engagement to make sure that there are adequate responses radiographically, endoscopically, and kind of making those decisions as a team. At least in our center, I would say that we do consider this as kind of established practice at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's the same with us at the University of Colorado. Professor Van Cutsem, for a site not in the United States. Tell us what's going on.
Officially, it's not in the label, of course, as was said, but yeah, I think it's standard today. However, this should be done in experienced hands, because what is challenging is the follow-up of these patients. If we go for a non-operative strategy, same is true in MSS patients who get a complete response also with chemo radiotherapy regimens. The follow-up and the evaluation at very frequent time points is important in this group of patients, and that includes digital rectal examination, endoscopy by an experienced endoscopist, plus MRI to look at these three different factors at different time points. But with that, we can cure patients and we can avoid the consequences and the postoperative morbidity of surgery and radiotherapy with Large syndrome and so on, and the small reservoir function.
But as you said, right, the surveillance here is significant and requires a lot of multidisciplinary management. Dr. Morris.
Yeah, I was just going to just add a comment as well that, you know, it's in the metastatic setting in the United States, biomarker testing is still not routinely performed, among all patients who are newly diagnosed with colorectal cancer. But for this particular subject, it's pretty straightforward. If a patient has localized non-metastatic disease or metastatic disease, we are ordering at MD Anderson, you know, MSI testing in all patients, regardless of the stage of diagnosis.
And, absolutely.
Having conversations with our pathologists that when you are confirming that adeno diagnosis when they're coming into the institution, go ahead and reflexively just get the MSI testing done, if it hasn't been done previously. So this should be, we feel our group, this should be performed in all patients.
Yeah, could not agree more. I'm going to stay with you. Do you believe that non-operative management here for these patients should be considered standard of care?
I mean, I think it's becoming that way. I mean, when we look at, non-operative management, but even before this has become, more of a reality for many patients who have complete clinical responses after TNT. And now this is another indication for non-operative management of localized rectal cancer as well. So we watch these patients closely, but this is, a real opportunity to get these patients to an excellent outcome and hopefully never exposed to the toxicities and morbidity of chemotherapy or radiotherapy.
Dr. Seligman.
The only caution I have is the limitations described is that I think the language that we've been very excited about the MSK data. Do we think that AZURE-1 is going to show 100% complete clinical responses? I'm not sure it is. And so I think we have to hope to get a complete clinical response. I think we shouldn't expect a complete clinical response. Yep. And we'll get more experience as time goes by. And of course, the pattern of relapse might be different here than what we see in the MSS disease. So really exciting and aiming towards non-operative management should be standard of care, but there's still a lot of data that we need.
Absolutely. Dr. Morris.
Yeah, exactly to that point. I mean, when you look at a lot of the data that Dr. Seligman presented, you're talking about path CR rates in the 60 to 70%. Even though the MSK data is 100%, there's early data from Nivo-Ipi in this population where they're showing, complete response rates of about 2/3 as well. So I agree, and this is an important thing we need to be talking to our patients about, which is, not everybody is guaranteed, that complete clinical response rate.
Yeah, totally agree. Dr. Seligman, you had produced such great workflows, right, in terms of the management of, like, say, T4 disease and T3. So, regarding this question for a patient with MSI high or MMR deficient, stage 2 or stage 3 colon cancer, so not rectal cancer. And I think that this is going to be a dilemma that clinicians are going to face kind of more and more as we get MSI testing or MMR testing, and it's not clearly a T4 lesion or not clearly N2, disease, at least by radiologic imaging. What would you do for that patient with T2, T3, MSI high colon cancer? Because you had kind of brought up the idea of, what does a hemicolectomy look like versus the toxicities of immunotherapy?
So we look to the biggest study that we have, which is NICHE, and we look at the inclusion criteria. And so I would feel very comfortable treating a T3 patient with immunotherapy, to be honest. And I know I might not everyone will agree with me. I think it should be given. I very strongly feel it should be given in the neoadjuvant setting. The data from melanoma and lung is extremely clear, is that when the primary is in situ, that is when you should be using immunotherapy. When we looked at the same group of patients in Foxtrot, we think they're really good prognosis patients, and some of them are, but some of them aren't. And so I think there is definite advantages over adjuvant chemotherapy. Yep. I don't think we are ever just going to give adjuvant immunotherapy. So in my view, given the risk versus the benefit, so this is different from chemotherapy, because the chances of the immunotherapy helping are higher. Right. Than with chemotherapy, the risk benefit is different. But remember, it's the patient that's taking that risk, not us. And right. So the important thing is to have the discussion. You could well be cured by surgery, or if we are going to give it to you, we need to give it to you now. So this is the crux, and Azure 2 again will help us answer this.
Great. Professor Van Cutsen.
Yeah, I think it's the question. I agree with what Jenny says, but the question is not so easy. It's easy. We see this MSI high patients quite often in elderly patients, a bit more women than men, with big tumors on the right side. And there it's obvious that immune therapy is a reference. But the question is, what do we do with a patient of, let's say, a 45-year-old, MSI high tumor, left-sided, non-Lynch related tumor? Surgery is laparoscopic surgery in these patients. They go home after one day, so it's low morbidity. So I think it's an open discussion in this group of patients that we need to have with the patient. I completely agree that it's okay to propose to the patients immune therapy. But on the other hand, it's also okay to propose surgery in this setting. And I think it's a balanced discussion with the patient mm-hmm. today.
Dr. Dasari.
So in patients who do get immunotherapy in colon cancer, thoughts on non-operative management if the patient especially doesn't want surgery, and how do you do surveillance, say if it's a right-sided tumor? What's the challenges that they pose?
Shall I take that? Yeah. So we don't. There is no protocol, yeah. And we there's a couple of research groups, including my own, that are looking at this very question, because we've done quite a lot of neoadjuvant immunotherapy trials, and you see patients who have a complete clinical response, yeah. And they say, well, why would you operate? I've seen this data. I think I'm cured. Why would I go for an operation to take out? On the other hand, we need a surveillance schedule. The surveillance schedule is going to be more difficult than it is for rectal cancer. Yep. It's going to need very skilled endoscopists. But why would you do an operation if you've cured a patient? ctDNA will help. But what we need is a proper protocol that is tested prospectively, rather than individual yeah. people trying to do their own similar to the ctDNA, because you'll just end up in a mess. So watch this space.
But the crux is that judging whether the tumor has disappeared as a complete response clinically before the operation in colon cancer is much more difficult
yeah,
than in rectal
yeah,
cancer.
Right? I agree.
You will not do as easily an endoscopy if the tumor is highly located. There is not the MRI that helps in this setting, so it's much more difficult. And that
but imagine your older patient. You know, that could be the perfect scenario, an older patient, if you could avoid an operation in particular. That would be a really worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah, this discussion, I think, really reflects the clinical confusion and quandary that we're kind of left in with an agent that has incredibly high response rates, really outstanding responses, but then you're kind of left with, well, the questions about surgery, every 3-month colonoscopy, ctDNA, and obviously we're hopeful that some of these studies, including Azure, when it reads out, will help answer these questions, but they won't answer all of them, as you well know. So still more to see. So Dr. Morris, is there a role for combining immunotherapy with chemotherapy in patients with high tumor burden or visceral metastatic disease?
Not in my practice. I mean, I think that there are, you know, trials which are looking at this question in the frontline setting, and that are enrolling in the United States right now. But this, you know, is not something that I typically would do. If a patient, you know, oftentimes these patients are going to have, bulky primary tumors. So if we are starting, you know, immunotherapy on them, I think this point of Dr. Seligman's about the stricturing, clinicians really need to be aware of this, because the patients present with an obstruction and your initial thought as an oncologist is like, oh gosh, like this tumor has progressed, this treatment's not working. And when in reality, it's working beautifully and it's strictured down. I don't think that all surgeons, I mean, you know, a general surgeon in the community may not be as familiar with, you know, the nuances of immunotherapy and the presentations and complications of those treatments. So this really needs to be on the differential diagnosis and the radar of surgeons as well.
Yeah, no, agree. And I know we need to move on, but I do want to get to this last question of this. And Dr. Dasari, you know, 67-year-old female with MSI-high colorectal cancer has a response on Pembro, but is now progressing. We know that this happens, right? So, you know, would you opt for Nivo-Ipi or chemotherapy in the second-line setting for this patient?
I mean, I'll preface my answer by saying that this is a data-free zone. So you probably talk to three people and you'll get five opinions. But in this patient, I think it would be reasonable to consider ipi-nivo. But if the patient says, no, I want to do chemo, I think it's hard to argue against that as well.
And I completely agree. No data to guide this decision. But this is a real-life situation that I know clinicians face. Okay. Thank you guys for that wonderful discussion. We're going to move on to Professor Van Cutsem to discuss integration of therapies targeting HER2 in the management of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure for me to be here at this RTP symposium, and also, if you listen carefully at the music choice made by Dr. Neil Love, we share the same preferences for the music. But what I've been asked tonight is to discuss with you on HER2 therapies. And indeed, here we saw a lot of progress. As you've heard in the beginning of this this symposium, that HER2, that around 2 to 4% of colorectal cancers are HER2 positive, more in left-sided compared to right-sided, more in RAS wild type compared to RAS mutant patients. And here you see a spectrum of different agents that are under investigation in different indications of colorectal cancer, going from the antibodies, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, zanidatamab, small molecules, a long list. I will discuss tucatinib since we have some recent data. Also, antibody-drug conjugates, and other bispecific antibodies. I will discuss the antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan, because we have also very nice data in colorectal cancer in this regard. The story started with some 15 years ago by our Italian colleagues who looked at preclinical models, HER2 positive PDXs, which are and showed that they were sensitive to dual HER2 blockade with the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab. When they looked in their preclinical xenografts, one of the two drugs was not active. So really, you can see that in the preclinical models that the combination of the two drugs was clearly more active in this setting. Our Italian friends did then a study, the Heracles-A study, which was the first study in HER2 positive colorectal cancers with the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib. It was a phase 2 non-randomized study, but what they've shown is that there was an objective response rate of around 30% in patients progressive, pre-treated on different treatments, and then treated with a combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib. And you can see the waterfall plots and also the duration of the response, which was quite nice in this initial study. later on, different studies, different combinations have been done, often with trastuzumab. And I want to highlight the MOUNTAINEER study, because that led to the approval of the combination of tucatinib and trastuzumab in HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer. Tucatinib being a TKI, as you know. And this study was done in patients in second line or later line, HER2-positive tumors based on immunohistochemistry, 3+ or 2+, followed by a positive FISH test. And initially there was a cohort tucatinib trastuzumab, and later on there was an expansion, randomized cohort B and C, tucatinib alone or the combination of tucatinib and trastuzumab. If you look at the data of the combination, because one agent, tucatinib alone, did not lead to a consistent activity, waterfall plots for this combination are nice. Objective response rates for this combination, again in an in not an extremely big study, but 84 patients was 38%, and as you can see also, the response rates were a bit higher in patients with an IHC3+ tumor, 47%, and 20% of the patients had an objective response when the tumor was IHC2+, followed by a positive ISH test in this setting. So there was also activity in this group, but the activity was higher in patients with the IHC3+ tumor. You can see the PFS curves, 8.1 months for the combination of tucatinib trastuzumab, and medium survival. I remember this was at least second line, but many patients later lines also, of around 24 months median survival with this combination. We looked then at different other factors. There were some long-term, very long-term responders. This was the case in around 1 out of 4 of the patients, and that was defined as more than 12 months of benefit of response. And we could find that in a different range of HER2 expression levels, as is shown here on the in this graph, and also, as was discussed already, you can do determine. Classically, we look at immunohistochemistry followed by a FISH test, but you can do also an NGS test or even a liquid biopsy. Looking at the response rates in with HER2, searching for HER2 positivity with these different methodologies, you can see that this was consistent, and I didn't mention that yet in detail, but the duration of response was also quite long. You can see it's over 15 months of duration of response in this setting. Every new treatment has adverse events. You can see that many of the adverse events in blue were grade 1 and 2. There were some grade 3 and 4, but they were not so frequent, as you can see. The most commonly tucatinib-related adverse events that you should be aware is diarrhea, fatigue, nausea, and then some dermatitis. But again, as I mentioned, in most of the patients, this is not grade 3 or 4. This is grade 1 or 2, as was reported. This was pre-treated patients. This treatment is now moving in first line. You've heard about the Beacon data in BRAF mutant patients. Well, in HER2 positive patients, there is now the MOUNTAINEER 3 trial is ongoing, and that's a randomized study in first line standard treatment, a chemo doublet with an EGFR antibody or with bevacizumab, versus combination of FOLFOX plus tucatinib and trastuzumab. The study is recruiting, so I cannot share any results yet, but we hope in the future to present some results. These are challenging, difficult studies. HER2 is not extremely frequent. We need to have the data for HER2 in first line to be able to recruit the patients in this trial. I promised to talk also on antibody drug conjugate. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is an antibody drug conjugate with a payload deruxtecan, which is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor linked to trastuzumab. Our Japanese colleagues did the Destiny CRC01 study, which was a study with different cohorts, HER2 positive, the blue cohort A, and then there, with the classic criteria, IHC3 plus or 2 plus followed by a positive ISH test. Cohort B and C were patients with low or extremely low HER2 positive tumors in this setting. There was no consistent activity in patients in cohort B and C, small cohorts, but there was a clear activity in patients with the HER2 positive tumors. You can see 45% of patients had a response. Again, in a non-randomized study, 53 patients, but consistent if you look through the story, lapatinib, trastuzumab, tucatinib, trastuzumab, and here trastuzumab, deruxtecan, all decent response rates in pre-treated patients. You can see the nice waterfall plots, the nice spaghetti plots reflecting on the long duration of benefit in this situation. And on the right side, the PFS curves and overall survival, the upper curve was always in the HER2 positive tumors for trastuzumab deruxtecan in this setting. There was a lot of biomarker data that were published recently in this setting. Also here, the bottom line message is that IHC3 plus patients do better compared to IHC2 plus patients followed with a positive ISH test. But there was some activity also in the 2 plus patients in this setting. After this Japanese study, there was another study done, the Destiny CRC02 study, which was a randomized study, looking also at different doses. You may be aware that trastuzumab deruxtecan in stomach cancer is used at a dose of 6.4 milligrams per kilogram. In many other indications, including breast cancer, and here there was an arm, therefore, also of 5.4 milligrams per kilogram, randomizing patients between these two. And then later on, there was an expansion at the 5.4 milligrams. And just to give you the bottom line message, 5.4 milligrams did really better. Response rates were a bit better compared to the 6.4, because more patients had to be dose reduced in the 6.4 or stopped. You can see that response rates here were 38% in the 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. There was also an extensive biomarker analysis. I will not go in detail, but again, to tell you that there was activity across different groups. So, also in patients with HER2 positive mutations, in patients with concurrent RAS mutations in this situation. And a few words on toxicity. Trastuzumab deruxtecan can lead to some side effects, chemotherapy-related side effects that you all know. But what you should be aware in this setting is that in analogy with stomach cancer, in analogy with breast cancer, ILD, interstitial lung disease, or pneumonitis occurs, let's say, in average in around 8 to 10% of the patients. And every oncologist who treats these patients should be aware of that and should be aware of how to treat these patients in this setting. The story is almost finished in this setting. We have seen in the past some data from my pathway studies, pertuzumab, trastuzumab. Many of these data are consistent. And very recently, we saw a new evolution also with a new antibody. I mentioned that zanidatamab is a bispecific antibody targeting binding on two different epitopes of the HER2 receptor. very small study. We know that that drug is approved for HER2-positive bile duct cancer. Well, in colorectal cancer, this is a study that was reported at the last ESMO meeting of chemo plus this antibody, low number of patients, but nice activity of chemo plus this antibody response rates, which were quite high in this group of patients, in this low number of patients. So to conclude, HER2-targeted therapy is there, is a reality in patients with colorectal cancer. I discussed with you the Mountaineer study leading to the FDA approval, not yet in Europe, of tucatinib trastuzumab, because it works. The study was in RAS wild-type patients, IHC3+, but also some activity in 2+ and positive ISH testing. That drug is also moved, or that combination is moved towards early lines. The DESTINY-CRC-02 study led also to, together with other studies, led also to the approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan in colorectal cancer at a dose of 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. It works in IHC3+. Also, but to a lower extent in 2+ patients. But it works also regardless of RAS status and regardless of prior anti-HER2 therapy. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Reinkatzen. Okay, Dr. Seligman, saw great data from Professor Reinkatzen's presentation. What is the optimal second-line treatment for HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer? So we have some options here, right? At least in the United States. So tucatinib trastuzumab or T-DXd?
For me, I would go with tucatinib trastuzumab. The risk of interstitial lung disease, I think, is quite real, and it's quite difficult to manage if a patient does develop it. So for me, that would be probably the main thing.
At the condition, I think, that, as I mentioned, in the setting that the tumor is RAS wild type.
It's RAS wild type, sure.
Because there are no data of tucatinib trastuzumab in RAS mutant patients.
Sure.
One of the things here we talked to Dr. Dasari's point earlier, too, though, is, you know, what is the role of sequential testing with the liquid biopsy as patients are progressing on treatment? And whereas, you know, if a patient with a RAS wild type colorectal cancer develops that acquired RAS mutation, you know, and you may hesitate against, you know, think twice about rechallenging at that point in time. I think if you see a RAS mutation come out of this, again, the TDX2, I still wouldn't, you know, allow that to deter me from, you know, letting the liquid biopsy results affect my decision to proceed with that as the next line.
Thanks, Dr. Morris. Dr. Dasari, in this situation where we have a 65-year-old female with stage 4 colon cancer that's IHC3+ for HER2, KRAS wild-type, BRAF wild-type, microsatellite stable, but has congestive heart failure, how do you use HER2-targeted therapy in patients with cardiac disease, especially if that LVEF is quite low, less than 45%, or with a history of non-ischemic or ischemic cardiomyopathy with heart failure with reduced EF?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always the concern, cardiac toxicities with HER2 therapies, especially trastuzumab-based therapies. I mean, would love to get the input from the rest of the panel, but I wonder if this might be a situation where if there are no other comorbidities, could we consider TDX over trastuzumab-based therapies? But would love to get input from the rest of the panel, too.
Dr. Seligman?
I mean, I think this is quite difficult because the trials just don't tend to include these patients, do they?
No, they do not.
And so that's one of the difficulties that we have when we're faced with real patients. But yeah, you that would make me quite nervous about using trastuzumab.
No, I totally agree. Dr. Morris?
Yeah, I would watch these patients very closely, but I would have a lot of hesitancy about a trastuzumab-related combination, too.
All right. Dr. Van Custom, a 90-year-old female with HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer, would you consider frontline anti-HER2 therapy for this patient, presumably in the absence of chemotherapy?
We don't have any data. 90-year-old, it's always a heavy and intense discussion do we treat the patients? I'm more reluctant to treat, but of course, occasionally there may be patients that we want to treat, but I would for sure be reluctant to treat the patient with HER2 targeted therapy in first line at the moment without any data.
Okay. Dr. Morris, a 66-year-old female with stage 4 HER2 mutated colon cancer. We get this question a lot, right? What is the optimal treatment? I think the question there is, is there any data of utilizing these agents in HER2 mutated colon cancer?
Yeah, I mean, not that I'm aware of here at all. I think if it's really the amplification, which Dr. Venkatesan kind of alluded to, just the high amplification seems to be the best predictive marker. So I have not been treating these patients with these agents.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Seligman, I'm going to move down to the third bullet point, a HER2 positivity definition. Is there any difference in colorectal cancer as opposed to the upper GI tract, presumably the stomach and esophageal cancers?
What I know is that the Mountaineer team have done a lot of work on this, and I think there are differences, but I don't think I could tell you exactly what they were. But certainly they have produced quite particularly against the technology or for what would be tested. And I think in reality, you test, I think more people will be moving towards a panel that includes HER2 more than anything. But in terms of the, I think we then stick to the inclusion criteria, but.
I think the criteria for HER2 positivity were quite similar in the different studies, IHC and IHC3+ or 2+ followed by a positive ISH test in this setting. What is different, but that's more for the pathologists, is that stomach cancer, HER2 expression is much more heterogeneous compared to colorectal cancer. And also some details on the basal membrane, you see more incomplete staining in stomach cancer compared to colorectal cancer. I'm not a pathologist, but that's what I've learned from our pathologists.
Dr. Venkatesan, newly diagnosed HER2 IHC3+ metastatic colorectal cancer with brain metastases, right? So we know that there's, likely a higher prevalence of brain mets with HER2 high expressing tumors. Would you utilize tucatinib trastuzumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan as your initial therapy due to the CNS activity?
Difficult question. I don't have a good answer. We would not be allowed to do that in Europe at the moment because it's not labeled in first line, not in the US neither. It's in pretreated patients. But regardless of the label, from what we know today, I would consider to treat a patient with trastuzumab deruxtecan if it's a fit patient without lung problems in this setting. Realizing that brain metastases are linked in colorectal cancer in first line with an extremely poor prognosis, but if the patient has a good organ function, is in good condition, maybe trastuzumab deruxtecan would be my preference to give the chemotherapy in the form of antibody drug conjugate in this setting. But I don't have strong arguments to underscore what I'm saying right now.
All right. And Dr. Zasari, can colorectal cancer metastases have heterogeneous HER2 status? In other words, a metastasis is positive, but a primary is negative. Also, can HER2 positivity emerge or be lost, as we see in breast cancer, other cancers, resulting in the need for multiple biopsies and retesting? And maybe an easier way to even ask this question is, how many times do you re-biopsy these patients prior to initiation of anti-HER2 therapy?
Great question, and I think that's something that's debated extensively, so I don't think we have a clear answer. But overall, I would say the KOLs I've talked to seem to want to confirm HER2 status before starting anti-HER2 therapy, especially if it's been quite a while since they were last tested and if they've received multiple lines of therapy in between. With regards to loss of HER2 positivity, while we don't necessarily test for it, we do see that patients with widely metastatic disease, you start them on anti-HER2 therapy, most of the disease is controlled, but perhaps one site is starting to grow. And if you could do local regional therapies to that site, put the patient back on the same therapy and get some more mileage out of that therapy.
Great. All right. Wonderful discussion. Exciting to talk about HER2 in the setting of colorectal cancer. And so thank you, Dr. Vancutsman, for presenting all that data. Okay, well, I get to wrap up by talking about KRAS G12C and colorectal cancer. And obviously, this is a story that's already been told in lung cancer, but now we get to talk about it in metastatic colorectal cancer. And I get to talk about not only just one FDA approval, but you know, after I actually made these slides, there was a second FDA approval for metastatic colorectal cancer in this space. So now is a good time to talk about KRAS G12C mutations and biomarker-directed therapy for our patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And I really wanted to start with this slide, which I actually attended GI ASCO in 2012. And this is a slide with the keynote address talking about strategies to target KRAS in colorectal cancer. And essentially, the line, right, from this talk, which is a phenomenal talk by Dr. Channing Durr, was that RAS was more or less undruggable, right? And, you know, we had, have data from anti-EGFR, TKIs like gefitinib or erlotinib, but that the binding with RAS GTP was 1,000 times higher. And so as a fellow, I was told, you can't target RAS, so just do anything other than go after RAS. And so that was 2012, ASCO GI. And of course, now here we are, right? And we're going to talk about two drugs, sotorasib and adagrasib, that now can target a specific isoform of KRAS G12C by binding in that pocket. Now, certainly, you know, we wish now that we have an actionable biomarker here that the prevalence of KRAS G12C mutations was higher, you know, than it is. But it is probably approximately 3 or 4% of all of our patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And what you see in this pie chart is kind of how those RAS mutations are really kind of broken down. And you see that G12C only represents a minority of the RAS mutations that we see. But this is, of course, actionable. And, of course, this is a rapidly evolving field in terms of RAS inhibition. But we're going to really focus on that 3% of G12C. And you know, and these are kind of small numbers, but this was a study that was published in 2023 suggesting that when you look at patients with metastatic colorectal cancer that have this KRAS G12C mutation, that they potentially have a poor prognosis. And so this obviously speaks to two things. Number one, that these patients have aggressive biology, but then number two, if there's an actual mutation here, it really needs to be targeted and likely early in its treatment course. And so I'm going to focus on two. I'm showing a slide here for adagrasib, but we're going to talk about adagrasib and sotorasib. These are covalent inhibitors of KRAS G12C. They irreversibly and selectively bind KRAS G12C in its inactive GDP-bound state, and then obviously maintaining that exposure of both adagrasib and sotorasib above your target threshold really inhibits that KRAS-dependent signaling. And we're also going to talk about this combination therapy with anti-EGFR agents. And this is really this common theme that you see. You've heard that with HER2 therapy. You've heard it with BRAF therapy, that this pathway has, there's a lot of redundancy in this pathway that requires dual inhibition, which is something that we don't necessarily see in other cancers. But this story really started, at least for colorectal cancer, with the KRYSTAL-1 study. This was adagrasib at 600 milligrams BID, and this was the phase one dose escalation, and there was an expansion of kind of essentially two different therapies, adagrasib monotherapy and adagrasib in combination with cetuximab. And there are obviously, different, you know, believe it or not, this phase one is actually still going on, but there's a significant expansion cohort in colorectal cancer. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2023. And what I'm showing you here is adagrasib monotherapy. And what you see here is an objective response rate of 23% by central review. No complete responses. There are 8 partial responses, 29% of patients with, or 29 patients with stable disease. That was 67% of the patient population. And the duration of response was 4.3 months. So not tremendously long, but still significant monotherapy response rates. And then when you look at sotorasib, this is from COBRAC 100. This is sotorasib monotherapy where the objective response rate was roughly 10%. But you can see that there's a significant number of patients that actually had some amount of tumor regression. So again, you know, even over the course of what you've heard over the last hour and a half, is this idea that when you have these targeted therapies, whether it's BRAF, whether it's HER2, that this dual inhibition really does make a difference when it comes to targeting these pathways in colorectal cancer. And it does really speak to the redundancy of the MAP kinase pathway, that when you inhibit just one, you know, essentially node or area, you have a lot of signaling that comes around that too. And so when you inhibit with anti-EGFR, you're likely to shut down the pathway in a much more effective manner. And certainly this is what we've seen when we've combined these KRAS G12C inhibitors in combination with cetuximab or panitumumab. So this was an update from AACR just this past year where you saw the combination of adagrasib and cetuximab led to a 34% objective response rate and a disease control rate of 85%. When you look at the progression-free survival, median progression-free survival was 6.9 months. Median overall survival was 15.9 months. And then when, you know, combining all this data, there was an FDA accelerated approval for adagrasib in combination with cetuximab for KRAS G12C mutated colorectal cancer that happened this past summer and represents, you know, our first successful attempt to target any KRAS mutation for colorectal cancer. I think this is a tremendous achievement. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about sotorasib in just a bit. I do want you to know that there's an ongoing phase 3 study, KRYSTAL-10. This is in the second line setting for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer that have a KRAS G12C mutation. These are patients that have progressed on frontline chemotherapy and are randomized 1-to-1 to receive adagrasib in combination with cetuximab or standard of care chemotherapy. The primary endpoints for this, progression-free survival and overall survival. When you look at the sotorasib data, that came from the CodeBreaK 300. And so this was a phase 3 study design in patients that have had previously treated KRAS G12C mutated metastatic colorectal cancer. And they're randomized in a 1-to-1-to-1 fashion where one of the arms was standard of care, trifluridine, tipiracil, or regorafenib. And then there are two arms investigating two different doses of sotorasib at 960 milligrams daily, in combination with panitumumab, or sotorasib 240 milligrams in combination with panitumumab. And the progression-free survival curves you can see here, median progression-free survival was highest in the 960 milligram arm in combination with panitumumab, 5.6 months, at the lower dose, 3.9 months, and with the investigator's choice therapy, 2.2 months. When you look at the overall response rates, the overall response rate for sotorasib at 960 with panitumumab, 26%, only 6% in the 240 milligram arm, and then 0% in the investigator's choice standard of care therapy. When you look at the tumor shrinkage from baseline, when you look again, I think I'm going to point you mainly to the top left-hand corner, 81% of those patients that received sotorasib at 960 milligrams with panitumumab had some amount of tumor shrinkage. And this study was not powered for overall survival. There's a trend when you look at the sotorasib-panitumumab arm of a trend towards overall survival improvement. But this data is, number one, still a little bit immature, and number two, the study wasn't necessarily powered to look for an overall survival benefit. But the FDA has approved sotorasib with panitumumab for KRAS G12C mutated colorectal cancer, and this just happened last week. And so we now have two different options for this patient population. And so it really speaks to the importance of biomarker testing early in the course of somebody's disease. And you can see that with the BRAF data that you've seen, HER2, and now KRAS G12C. There are other KRAS G12C inhibitors. I want to show you data from divarasib that showed a 29% confirmed response rate. And this is just divarasib in a single agent or monotherapy setting. I do want to point you to, you know, given what Dr. Morris has already told you about this upcoming abstract of BRAF inhibition in a frontline setting, there is some data here of KRAS G12C inhibition in the frontline setting. So this is CodeBreaK 101 subprotocol H, which took patients that had a KRAS G12C mutated metastatic colorectal cancer and combined it with chemotherapy in the frontline setting. So this is a frontline cohort combining essentially FOLFIRI with sotorasib at 960 milligrams daily with panitumumab. When this data was initially presented at ASCO in 2023, the overall response rate in total was 55% for this patient population with a disease control rate of 93%. This was actually, and you're seeing the waterfall plots here showing that a majority of those patients obviously had some amount of tumor shrinkage, but an overall response rate of 55%. this data was just updated at ESMO just a couple of months ago, and with more mature data, the overall response rate is now 78%. That is an unbelievably high response rate, but again, this is a small study. It's only 40 patients, and you can see that there is activity even in patients with liver metastases, with left-sided tumors and right-sided tumors, and 95% of the patients did achieve disease control. So when you look at sotorasib and panitumumab, you can see that a lot of the side effects there were rash, and then you can see some nausea that's known to be a class side effect of the KRAS inhibitors. So just some take-home points, right? We know that KRAS G12C is a small but very important subset of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. There's emerging data with sotorasib, panitumumab, adagrasib, and cetuximab, and that has led to approved regimens now for both regimens for KRAS G12C mutated metastatic colorectal cancer. Similar results seen with other KRAS G12C inhibitors in the field is obviously becoming increasingly crowded. And I would say the combinations are well tolerated, but it's important, and those that treat lung cancer know this even better than us, that the dermatologic toxicity as well as the nausea toxicity really need to be managed well. And early data with chemotherapy FOLFIRI show, just tremendously impressive response rates. And I'll close with this slide, basically, you know, showing you that this is becoming a vastly, you know, or a very quickly evolving field, and we're going to see more and more KRAS inhibitors, not just G12C inhibitors, but you're seeing G12D inhibitors in phase one trials. You're also seeing pan-RAS inhibitors coming online, not only in colorectal cancer, but also in other diseases like pancreas cancer, and it will be really interesting to see what happens in the future. Thank you, guys. All right, so you know, we're going to wrap up with some of these questions regarding KRAS G12C. So start with Dr. Van Cutsem. You know, can we incorporate KRAS inhibitors into the frontline setting rather than waiting for second line and the relapse setting?
Not yet today. Too early. The data that you presented are very nice, but we need to see a bit more randomized data. And then colorectal cancer is a kind of continuum of care, and then we have to place where it's going to be the exact place. Today it's later lines, may move up to second line, maybe later to first line, but not yet today.
Yeah. Dr. Seligman, which is the better frontline therapy for a patient with metastatic colorectal cancer and a KRAS mutation, chemo plus an EGFR antibody or a KRAS inhibitor plus an EGFR antibody?
I think you know what I'm going to say. So out of the two, what would I like to give would be chemotherapy plus a KRAS inhibitor plus an EGFR antibody, certainly not chemo plus an EGFR antibody. In reality, I think as it stands at the moment, you'd want to give somebody doublet chemotherapy, triplet chemotherapy plus a VEGF.
Absolutely. Yep. No, totally agree. Dr. Morris, you know, we now have two FDA-approved regimens in this setting. How would you decide between adagrasib and sotorasib, either as monotherapy or in combination with an anti-EGFR antibody? And what about divarasib?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, we don't have head-to-head data with adagrasib cetux versus sotorasib and panitumumab. There's no data to drive that decision-making. You know, I did my residency in North Carolina where, you know, this alpha-gal, you know, anaphylaxis with anti-EGFR therapies is a real thing. We also see this in the United States in like the Ozark Mountains, kind of Missouri, Arkansas area as well. So if I'm living in these areas where we know that patients, it's like there's a high rate of anaphylaxis with cetuximab, I'm going to go for the panitumumab sotorasib option, you know, in these patients. In Houston, where I live, I don't like know that I prefer one or the other. I would say anecdotally when we were doing the adagrasib cetuximab trial at MD Anderson, it did, you know, seem there were a lot of kind of drug-drug interactions, you know, with the metabolism. So I think being mindful as well of the concomitant medications patients may be on and how that's going to interact, you know, is something we always are going to check with our pharmacist as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Dr. Dasari, would you consider using alternate combinations of sotorasib and adagrasib and an EGFR antibody?
Not sure I understood the question completely.
Is there any time I think that you would either use both?
Switch the EGFR antibody in the combination?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we have data, but I wouldn't be too concerned,
right.
I guess, especially in situations like Dr. Morris discussed.
I think, you know, even within our system, we've built treatment plans with both anti-EGFR antibodies. Again, to Dr. Morris's point, if you ask, you know, those that are in the Southeast, they just can't get cetuximab, right? And that's a well-known thing. Dr. Seligman, how would you sequence targeted treatment for a patient with KRAS G12C positive HER2 IHC 3 plus metastatic colorectal cancer? That would be an unusual situation.
The needle in the haystack.
For sure. But is there a sequencing here that you would utilize?
So I think I'd quite just like to make a general point, is that it's very, very difficult to get evidence on these very rare alterations out with the very basic questions that are answered in clinical trials. I don't think in some ways we won't know how to deal with maintenance, because usually our maintenance trials have got hundreds of patients. We're never going to be able to produce data for all of these situations. I honestly don't know. I think my gut would, I would probably treat the KRAS mutation, but I really can honestly say I've got no great fundamental basis to base that on.
Dr. Morris.
Yeah. And I think I would just probably ask, like, what is the context in which this question is being asked? So again, if we go back to the anti-EGFR setting, you know, when these patients progress on EGFR inhibitors, you see these very low variant allele frequency, like 0.1, 0.2% KRAS, you know, mutations, which if I saw a G12C of a 0.1 in a patient who had progressed out of an anti-EGFR therapy, I wouldn't be jumping to a G12C combination in that setting, because we know that that's not really what's oncologically driving that person's colorectal cancer. So I'm just trying to like think what test report was in front of the oncologist who saw this. And I'm just wondering, like, was there a patient who had progressed on a HER2-directed therapy and developed an acquired low variant allele frequency, you know, VAF of a KRAS G12C mutation?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yep. All right. I know we kind of addressed that third point that it's just hard to know, right, which KRAS G12C therapy to use. And as we discussed before, not really any head-to-head data there. Dr. Van Kusten, 54-year-old female with stage 4 colon cancer and a KRAS G12C mutation, that has a response on adagrasib and panitumumab, but severe cutaneous AEs despite antibiotics and steroids. Do you ever use dose or schedule modifications to EGFR monoclonal antibodies in patients with severe cutaneous toxicity?
Yes, the answer is yes. I think EGFR antibodies give quite some skin toxicity. So I think in this situation, we have to follow the recommendations of what we do with FOLFOX plus panitumumab or cetuximab or FOLFIRI plus or minus the cetuximab in this setting. Yes, so we do those modifications of as well panitumumab as cetuximab, as well as careful interaction with the dermatologist to treat these patients with the classic treatments that are used for EGFR-targeted agents. Yep.
Absolutely. And Dr. Seligman, you know, one of the things that we know with this regimen is the nausea that can occur with it. So in this patient on adagrasib and cetuximab, a lot of nausea, a lot of fatigue. Any recommendations for management?
I mean, obviously, you can optimize antiemetics quite often. Sometimes patients will be able to will do well on one rather than another. So there's some basic things that you could think about in the first line, particularly if she's stable. But I think in a lot of these situations, you do end up having to dose reduce, and better to dose reduce and continue than try to continue on the higher dose with really poor quality of life and unacceptable toxicity, which this would be.
Yep, absolutely. Just to kind of follow back, we've had some great questions come in just from our in-person attendees. Also, a lot of great questions from our Zoom attendees as well. I'm going to actually throw this to Dr. Dasari. There's a question about the quantitative level of the Signatera test, you know, especially levels less than one. Are there false positives even in the surveillance setting?
Yeah, great question. And we do have some patients have very, very low level positive. And some of these could indeed be false positives related to how the assay is run. And there's also this phenomenon of spontaneous clearance that has been described, where patients who have really low levels of ctDNA, even without any treatment, seem to clear their ctDNA. So there's also that phenomenon. Now, the difficult part with trying to tease all this out is, what's the ground truth here? I mean, what are we comparing to figure out whether it's false positive or not? I think that's the challenge. So typically in these patients, I think it would be reasonable to get a repeat ctDNA test in a short interval, perhaps in about 3 months, to get a better idea.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thank you. All right, well, I think that will conclude our program tonight. On behalf of all the panelists, I just want to say thank you so much for attending tonight's event. And to our faculty members, just a wonderful discussion. You guys handled a lot of difficult questions, a lot of clinical conundrums very, very well. Really appreciate the discussion. I hope everybody found that helpful. Thank you, guys.